I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This music is from the soundtrack of The Way, a film starring Martin Sheen, and my guest today, his son, actor, writer, and director, Emilio Estevez. The music plays as father and son hike along the famous pilgrimage route, the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain. Emilio himself has come a long way since his days as a movie star in such films as The Breakfast Club, Repo Man, and The Outsiders. He took a sharp detour away from his Brat Pack career to become one of the most admired and stubbornly anti-commercial independent filmmakers in the business today. Estevez's latest film is The Public. It's a fictional standoff between cops and a group of homeless people occupying the Cincinnati Public Library. We discussed the movie at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor as part of the 2018 Hamptons International Film Festival's Conversations With series.
There's so many things to cover, but one thing that comes to mind is your family and you growing up in a family where your dad, of course, is this legendary movie star, and he worked on Broadway his career, and later in life I saw him do the Shakespeare with Pacino with the Public when they did Julius Caesar in the 80s, and then he has a career in television later in his career, which is as big as you can get on a huge hit show. And I was wondering, growing up in your family, you and your brothers, did that seem an inevitability, or you weren't sure?
You know, so much of it was having access to seeing how the sausage is made. And, you know, I grew up, I was 5-6 years old backstage at the Public Theater and watching productions of, Shakespeare in the Park, where he was playing Romeo, or The Naked Hamlet, which was Hamlet is happening, not really understanding what it was that my father did, but it seemed fascinating enough to say, you know what? What is? I might want to do that. That's interesting to me.
He never pushed or
no. In fact, they stressed that that I should go on and further my education and get a degree in something and have a solid foundation.
And did you?
And I did not. No, I did not. In fact, they still think I'm in medical school.
What's the first thing you do professionally?
Well, the first thing I did non-professionally was when I was about 10 years old, my folks bought a movie camera, like an 8mm camera. And that was at a point where, they came in these cartridges and you put the cartridge. So it was very easy to load and very easy to shoot. And so I started making home movies when I was 10 years old. It wasn't until I was in high school that I got involved in the theater department, started acting on stage in school, wrote my own play, performed it, and my father came to see that play. It was at public school, Santa Monica High School. And he, after the show, he said, "My God," he says, "you got the bug. You got it." And he understood that there was something going on inside of me where I could not do it.
Your mother was an actress as well, right?
No, she was a painter. She got a scholarship to the New School. As a fine artist, and she met my father. In fact, he was living on a couch at a mutual friend of theirs' house, and Jim Tiroff. And Jim wanted my dad off of his couch, so he says, "Hey, I got a great gal for you." And so they went on a date. My mother hated him, and yet 3 weeks later, they were living together in New York, and they've been together ever since. It's 57 years.
Yeah. Wow. So the first job for you, professional job, is it a TV show or a film?
It's a film called Tex.
So you do Tex with Matt Dillon.
Matt Dillon.
And how did that come about?
Basically, the audition process. I'd been auditioning since I was about 16. My friends in high school would drive me. I didn't have a car, so they'd drive me to an audition. My first professional audition was for Alan Parker. He was directing a film called The Fame.
Right.
So I auditioned. I didn't really know what the hell I was doing, but I started auditioning. I didn't get my first job until I was 18. It was the day I graduated high school. It was an after-school special. And it was, you know, you back in the day, you had to have a piece of film. It wasn't, you know, I had a couple of monologues. I had a William Inge, Dark at the Top of the Stairs, and I had a Shakespearean monologue. And you'd go in and you'd audition for casting directors, but they're like, oh, okay. But it wasn't until you had a piece of film that you could show and you know, use that to hopefully help you get jobs. So once I had that 30-minute after-school special, it sort of launched me into getting better auditions for better directors.
It really was this suffocating catch-22, which is you'd be in a room and you'd audition, and someone would say, man, I think you're fantastic. And the moment someone else hires you, you call me.
Right.
You know, bring me your film. Bring me the clip of you in a movie that someone else put you in. They all needed you, you know, for someone else to validate you.
You know, I auditioned initially for 16 Candles, which was John Hughes's first film. And so I walked into the audition. It was for a role that was eventually played by an actor called Michael Schuffling. And I prepared for it, and I came in, and I killed it. I mean, I killed the audition. I thought, man, I've got this hands down. I walked out of the room. I was like, yes, this is mine. Michael Chinich, who, if you remember, was a casting director at Universal, walks me out, and he says, hey, listen, man, you're not going to get this role. I said, well, what do you mean? I killed it. He says, no. He says, it's not going to happen. But here's what is going to happen. He says, you're going to get in your car, and you're going to drive over to Santa Monica, Venice area. There's Vicky Thomas is casting this film called Repo Man. You're going to go audition for that, and that you got a better shot at getting that film. I was like, ugh. So I was so angry about not getting 16 Candles, I drove over to this audition with all of that anger, which I think fueled me getting the part.
In Rippleman. This is before Outsiders.
This is before Outsiders, correct.
Before Outsiders. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I remember when you're in those early days of casting, it is so bizarre. Like, I'll never forget, I did a TV show for CBS, and the woman who was the head of talent, or I forget her title, was Christopher Guest's mother, Jean Guest, who was this very elegant, lovely woman who had this big office in TV City in L.A., and there was an executive who worked with her. I'll never forget. You're first starting out, and you don't know what's what. I mean, I didn't know what's what. You come from a family where you probably have that advantage over me, and I go there, and the pilot we did bombed. And we're in a room, and they go, don't worry about it. We're going to sign you to a holding deal. We're going to sign you to a network holding deal where we pay you money, not a lot of money, just to not work for anybody else. And you're going to work for us. And this guy leans in and goes, we think you're great, man. We're going to make you the next Bill Bixby.
Oh, God.
I remember sitting there going, you know, well, I guess they think that's a good thing. I should probably think that's a good thing.
Well, you know, and oftentimes as actors, we get criticized, well, why did he make that choice? Why did he choose? Sometimes it doesn't come down to a choice. Sometimes the movie picks you. You know, the day I auditioned for Breakfast Club, I had to audition for a Chips episode. I had to audition for a Taco Bell commercial. And it was just like they just happened to say yes. Right? And sometimes it is just a matter of that. And someone, you know, casting you in their film. And it's luck. And it's timing. And oftentimes we're criticized for, why'd you make that choice? Well, the choice wasn't up to us.
Who directed Repo Man?
Alex Cox. He went on and he did a great picture after that called Sid and Nancy.
Yeah, Sid and Nancy. Describe what the process was like with Coppola.
Oh, well, you know, Francis likes a very long, protracted casting sessions, and so he likes to sort of create a gladiator mentality. So he had actors from all over town. In fact, I think some of these audition tapes have made the rounds online. But you've got Dennis Quaid and Mickey Rourke and Tom Cruise and everyone in town at the time who could have been right for that film were all in this pit. And Francis would say, now you're going to play this part, and so you may have just audition for a specific role, and now you're watching Patrick Swayze do it, or you're watching Rob Lowe do it, or Tom Cruise do it, and it's like, oh God, he's so much better than me. I'm never going to get this, and it created a real sense of competition, and it was exhausting. And then he took I think four or five finalists from the LA auditions. We all flew to New York, and we did the same process at the Brill Building, and it was exhausting, but ultimately. I think that Francis knew who his guys were going to be, and those were the ones that did fly to New York were the ones that ended up in the film.
And what was the experience like shooting the film?
He early days. He was involved in I think it's called chroma key, where you can basically affect the background of a location. We'd stand on an empty set, and we would shoot basically the entire film. So it was 2 weeks rehearsal. You remember, back in the day, it wasn't a question of whether or not you were going to give 2 weeks. You gave 2 weeks of rehearsal. It was, you showed up 2 weeks early for so that was, for the 2 weeks prior to shooting, we had completed, top to bottom, shooting the entire film. But now you're lucky if your actors show up the day before you start shooting.
Right. You don't seem like you're all in on the movie stardom thing.
Well,
this seems like a piece of you that's, you know, uncomfortable. And is that accurate? Because it seems like you're, So yes. Describe that.
I never got into this business to be famous. I got into it to be a working actor. Like my father. He sort of set the tone. In fact, when I was starting, he says, you know what, no one's going to remember your name. No one's going to know your name. Just do the work. Do the work. And he just kept stressing that. And he says, and if you're lucky enough, you'll keep working until you're old. And so I've been very lucky, and I've made some good choices, and I've made some bad ones. But I've never been comfortable with the autographs and the selfies and now. But all the stuff that comes with it, because it felt like it was so far away from the reason we became actors to begin with.
That whole thing of like gaming your career, you know. My agent said to me, we're going to send a script over to you, and it's for a movie that was with a big director. It was kind of an action film, kind of a very, you know, crazy action drama. And it was the most money I would ever be paid in a movie. And he sends the script over, and the messenger comes, and I open the door, and I sit down. I just devour it. I just sit right down and read it. And I call up my agent, and I go, you know, God, I want to love it, man. I want to love it. I really wanted it. I mean, I never wanted to love a movie more in my life than this movie. I said, but I can't do it. I don't get it. I don't get what they want. I don't know how I could do that. I mean, maybe they need a different kind of guy. And he goes, do me a favor. He says, why don't you come on over to my office? And he goes, and I want you to read the script again. In my office. He goes, and we have a light. We have a special light we have in the office. And the light we have projects onto the page the amount of money you're going to get paid to be in the movie. Would you do that for me? Would you come over to the office and read the script again with our special light we have here at CAA? And I laughed and everything. But I mean, you realize, like, you know, getting it right, getting it wrong. I always, I kind of gave up. I was like, I don't know what the right answer is.
Sure.
Now, as you're going along and making films, you work with Hughes. What was he like to work with?
He was very childlike.
I loved him.
He was very curious about everything. Yeah. And that's what made him, I think, such a terrific filmmaker, is that he asked questions about you all the time. He says, well, how are you feeling? What's going on in your life right now? And you know, look at this old draft of the script. And what do you think of, you know, I cut this out and maybe you can figure out how to make this work. He was very collaborative, and it takes a lot of confidence, I think, and especially as I think it was his second time that he had directed at that point with me. But to have the confidence to trust your actors the way that he did during that experience was a real lesson for me.
He's the only person I know who rolled the camera, and he'd write notes on like a cue card with a magic marker while we were rolling.
Right.
So you're sitting there, and Elizabeth McGovern would say, ask me, you know, I was supposed to be the sophisticated rich kid, and I've been all over the world. She's like, but God, you must have been everywhere. You've been so many places. You know, tell me about some of the places you've been. And he would write a city, and then he'd write like a really crude association. He'd write Berlin, lesbians, and he'd hold it up. And I go, well, you know, Berlin has got, you know, it's just teeming with lesbians, and I'm reading this off the card, and he's like holding it, he's going, da, 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 you know,
right.
He was crazy. He was really, really so
and
much fun
to
shoot.
He would play music too. He would play music and drive the sound people nuts. But during the filming of a scene, he would just start some music.
Like Cameron, yeah. Cameron Crowe plays a lot of music. Now, at what point that you're doing this, because you work with some, you know, fantastic directors, does the directing thing begin to dawn on you?
Well, you know, I did an adaptation of an S.E. Hinton novel, and it was perhaps the least successful of the four that were turned into films. It was a movie called That Was Then, This Is Now, and for a lot of different reasons, the picture just didn't work. And so I was very frustrated coming out of that experience, and I was 23 years old, and I said, that's not going to happen next time. I'm going to direct. And I surrounded myself with I wrote the script that was terrible. And I surrounded myself with an amazing group of technicians. Robert Wise was my executive producer and ended up being a mentor to me. Michael Kahn, who's Spielberg's editor, cut it. Dennis Gastner was our production designer. Danny Elfman wrote the score. I mean, I was surrounded and supported by this extraordinary group of people. And I had a terrible script, and I shot it anyway. And I was convinced that no one was going to tell me what to do. And I should have listened to them, and they should have told me what to do.
This is a hint.
No. This is another movie called. Anyway, so.
I have on Blu-ray.
You've got a couple of
Yeah,
on,
right. We'll talk.
So, anyway. And so I came out of that experience bruised and broken, and I said, well, I'm going to do it again. And that was another film that I did with Charlie, which was lighter, and it was Men at Work, and it was silly. And my mother pulled me aside, and she's the rock of the family, and she's the most practical one in our group. And she just said, you know, you're making movies about things you don't know anything about. Make films about what you know. And what do you know? You know about family, you know about people. And so my focus changed. I make folk movies. I believe I make folk movies. And it started with, you know, I did this deal with the devil. I agreed to do a third Mighty Ducks film, which for Disney, in exchange for the funding to do a pet project of mine. It was a movie called The War at Home, where I played a character who was suffering from PTSD, Vietnam veteran. And so I do Mighty Ducks, and I go off to Texas, and I make War at Home, and Kathy Bates is in it, and my father plays my father, Kimberly Williams. It's a four-hander, and it's based on James Duff's play, Homefront, which Carol O'Connor originated the role that my father played. So I thought, you know, I got this in hand. This is four people in a house. This is something I know. It's about a dysfunctional family. I know a lot about that. So most of us do. So the movie was released on four screens and sort of disappeared. And outside of the festival circuit, not many people ever heard of it. But that experience sort of informed moving where I was going to go. And it was to make movies that mattered. I didn't care what the cost was emotionally to me. I knew that it was the road that I was going to take was going to be very difficult. But I wanted to make films. I wanted to change the direction of my career.
And did you decide?
There's a lot on this reel that I'm not proud of. You know, I mean, it's some fun. Yeah, I had.
Where do you see my reel? but at that point, when you say you make this decision, is coupled with that decision, you know, side by side with that decision, do you think? And I'm willing to stop. Not deciding, but you're willing to stop starring in films as an actor, films you don't want to make anymore.
Sure. Yeah. Oh yeah. No. And you have to say this is a sacrifice I'm willing to make. Yeah. I literally want to make a right hand turn. And I think, you know, much to the dismay of agents and managers who were making a lot of money off of some of the poorer decisions that I was making, they were not necessarily as supportive as you would have imagined. Right?
I love when you do a movie and, you know, I would make some decisions like I think, yeah, I want to take my wife on a vacation to Rome. And so this is all appended to someone saying, come to Rome and make this movie. And it was such a bad movie, you know. But of course, it all sounds better when the person on the other end of the phone is Italian, you know. they're like, you come and the movie is a video game, but the movie. And you are the game master. You're like a floating head in the screen. And you were talking to all the people trapped in the maze. And you say to them, you know, you have served me well. Proceed to level 5, you know. And you are the game master. And I'm like, that doesn't sound that bad. We'll take my wife to Rome for 2 weeks. I'm like, yeah, we'll do that. And then afterward, you're like, oh, God.
What have
you're
I
like
done?
Sobbing. What have
yeah,
I done?
Yeah,
what have I done?
Yeah. And it lives forever.
It lives forever.
And especially at night when you're grilling. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Library is now closed. Please exit the building. Once again,
what's going on? Nobody's leaving.
Patrons are staging an action.
What are they protesting?
Freezing to death.
What's it going to be, Mr. Goodson?
either one of us or you're one of them, right?
That's a clip from The Public, Emilio Estevez's latest film starring Taylor Schilling, Michael K. Williams, and Emilio himself, among many others. When we come back, Emilio Estevez talks a bit about his dad's arrest record, the role of libraries in America, and what I was doing in his dreams. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. The activism at the core of Emilio Estevez's new movie is rooted in the Sheen family's long history of political engagement.
The Public is a celebration of nonviolent civil disobedience. I grew up in a household where that was celebrated. You know, my father's been arrested 68 times for civil disobedience, peaceful, going against nuclear proliferation, immigration, and homelessness. So thank God we've solved all three of those problems.
I love that you know the exact number. I see the Estevez household, the Sheen household, and he comes out of jail and everyone's there with a cake with a number on it. Congratulations, well, Dad. Number 68. We're proud of you. There's like jail buttons, bars on the cake, or handcuffs.
In the late 80s and the 90s, he would regularly, it would end up on the evening news, sometimes the national news, and he would be carted off to jail and in cuffs, and he'd be screaming at the top of his lungs either the Lord's Prayer or the Tagore poem, Let My Country Awake, and he looked like a lunatic. And I would say, and my mother would just be shaking her head, and I didn't really understand. I understood it fundamentally. I understood what he was doing, but I didn't understand it spiritually. I didn't get it. But I do now. I understand that we have to stand up, and we have to embrace what Reinhold Niebuhr called the sublime madness. And that is, you know you're going to lose, but you cannot not do it. It's the Jean-Paul Sartre quote, I don't fight fascists because I think I will win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. But I'm not, you know, again, that was at the core of who my father is. And I think that has informed, to circle back around, the kinds of films that I'm interested in making. I'm interested in emotional and spiritual transformation. As I said, I'm interested in movies about people. I don't know how to make a movie in outer space. I've never been there, right? And it doesn't particularly interest me. We've got a lot to solve on this planet, so let's focus on what's going on.
It's funny when you said that your mother said, do movies you know, and I thought your response would have been something like, you know, well, Kubrick didn't go to outer space, Mom.
No,
you know?
And Coppola never went to Vietnam.
Right.
I'm sure you could make an argument for all of that.
Right. That's not your filmmaking. You want to do what you know.
Yeah, and I also have to work within the parameters of the budget some.
We're going to get to that. But you get to a movie like Bobby, mm-hmm. That looks like it's a lot of money for an independent film.
No, we started, that budget started at around $5.5 million.
Yeah.
And it had an enormous cast.
Yeah, it's a big movie.
And again, and that was sort of one of the challenges, as it was with The Public, and to a lesser degree, but balancing everybody's schedules. Because so on Bobby, as on this, you've got Sharon Stone for 5 days, you've got Demi Moore for 6. They're supposed to be in a couple of the same scenes, but they're scheduled on during different weeks. How do we figure this out? You got Bill Macy, you got Tony Hopkins, you got Elijah Wood, you got Lindsay Lohan who won't come out of her trailer. So you're doing this juggling thing, and you're on a very tight budget. So it's like you're watching the sun go down, the hours tick away, and it's like, how are we going to make this impossible schedule? And so that is the challenge when you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of time to make it look flawless, to make it look
like
seamless, and make it look like a movie, and make it look like everybody was there at the same time,
yeah.
Which I think we accomplished, and we did it again here on The Public. But I watch myself sort of age, right? and not slowly. I just watch myself get more and more tired. And if you're shooting out a sequence, of course, and you need to be tired at the end of the movie, like I am in The Public, it creates a bit of a problem.
With each movie you make, do you come out of the movie? I mean, I like movies because when you come out of the movie, you've learned so much.
Sure.
Is that the same way it is for you directing?
It is, and I think as a director, and if you've also written the screenplay, you have to be accountable to every character. And so when an actor comes the night before shooting, it's like, who is this guy and what's he doing? And, you know, how did he get here? And what's his relationship to so-and-so? You've got to write backgrounds for a lot of these characters. And so that's just a whole nother layer of work. And again, I've had a lot of years, in particular on the public. I've been working on this film for almost 12 years. It's a fifth of my life I've devoted to this. So I had a lot of time to think about it.
And you know, the are there films you write or you develop with other writers, are there films that you have like pots on the stove that you then you find that you chuck them and you say, I'm not going to make that?
No.
You don't?
No.
You've never had that experience?
No.
And we would imagine that would be very painful.
I did write a sequel to The Way. I tried to convince my father to do.
And but you says, couldn't afford him.
I couldn't afford him. And he says, I'm not going there. And I'm not, you know, I'm too old to walk again. And I said, well, you'll be on trains. And no. So yeah, that was, that's probably the only one so far that had to get chucked.
Right.
Yeah.
The public, nearly everything that's plaguing this country right now is touched upon in this film. In terms of community, in terms of education, in terms of poverty and homelessness, in terms of identity, spirituality, what have you. There's so much that I think is what's really, really wrong with our country today, beyond what you see on the surface and what's covered by the news that's touched upon in this film. Mm. And I was wondering, when you write a screenplay like this, do you write a 180-page screenplay, yeah, 150, and then you whittle yeah. it down, whittle yeah, it down? Describe that.
Well, I wrote this coming off of Bobby. I was feeling, and again, the movie is what it is, but there was a lot of attention around the film, and we were nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Picture, and we got the SAG nomination, and so there was a lot of energy about what I would be doing next. So the first draft of The Public was 155 pages, and I said, I'm not changing a word. and of course, you know, we ended up with 108 or 109 page final draft, but it was as inflated as I could possibly get it, because I thought there's so many other stories I want to tell, there's so many other characters I want to explore, and so I just kind of had this enormous canvas. The story was initially informed by a piece in the LA Times written by a former librarian, Chip Ward, who was retiring, and the thesis of the essay was that libraries have become de facto homeless shelters, librarians have become de facto social workers, and I can't sustain this any longer, and this is an epidemic. And so I was so moved by the piece that I began to do the research and began to write the script.
Is there ever a thought for you that you're not going to play these roles in the films and you're going to cast somebody, or do you always say to yourself, I got this, you're going to play that part?
You looking for the job?
Yeah. No, I'm just saying...
Because I want to work with you again. Yeah.
You all heard it now. As good as ink on a page now, buddy.
I'm looking.
No, but
writing.
You know what I mean? I directed one movie. I hated every minute of it. It was not my thing. I didn't have the patience for it. Mm-hmm. I just
didn't. You forgot to cover yourself? You know, you'd covered everybody else.
We go into the editing room, and I turn to my assistant director, the director's assistant, and I go, we have a super tight close-up in that shot. Don't we? She'd look at the page, she'd go, no, we don't. And I was like, the person whose performance was the most neglected was my own, and I played the lead in the movie. But what was interesting is that I realized that it is tough. I mean, what a muscle you have to have to star in and to direct a film. You really, really have to have a special gift. And I'm wondering, has it ever been problematic for you? Do you ever think to yourself that you know, there's a lot of great, you know, Ronnie Howard is a great director who had a huge career as a TV star, and you never see him in his movies. You ever want to go back to directing only?
Sure. I mean, I think it would depend on the story. And right. I think if it just didn't make sense for me to be in it, absolutely, I would step back. And, you know, in The Way, I had a very small role, and Bobby had a very limited role. So it was... I think, sure. I'm open to that.
So the last question I'll ask before we go out into the house here is that you'd make studio films, big films in your lifetime. Mm. You go in and you shoot, and you're an actor, and you go on, and in the time that they're finishing that movie, right, you've shot two or three more movies in that
right.
time, you know?
That's right.
And now you are... You are prepping the movie, and you are shooting the movie, and you're posting the movie, and you have to raise money for the movie, and then you've got to sell the movie and market the movie. Take us through that process. Just give us a little bit of this film.
I left Los Angeles for Cincinnati, where we shot the film, right after the election. I drove out from Los Angeles. I started the prep, and that was November of 2016. So when you commit to making a film, especially an independent film, you know you're in it a minimum of 2 years. The editing process can be, again, a very long period. I'm a big fan of test screenings, which, you know, of course every studio wants to do, and I'm all for it. I think that the only way to know how your film is playing is to take it for a test drive. See how it's
does that cost
see
money
how it's
too?
Playing. It's about $10,000 to run these what are called NRG, National Research Group test screenings. And you have to fill an auditorium, 300-400 people, and the price goes up depending of how big that auditorium is, that theater is. So these items just start racking up. And you know, we were fortunate enough to have an Ohio tax credit, which came at a terrific time in the process. So it gave us an influx of cash, and we were able to continue working on the film. But again, because, as you mentioned, this movie deals with so much. It is a big, giant adult portion. I wanted to make sure that we got it right. I took the film down to the ALA conference down in New Orleans and screened for thousands of crazy librarians, and they went wild for the film. But again, that's a process. Getting it there, three screenings in the middle of a big conference. You commit to doing all of that. You commit to an extended period of time where you're going to think about nothing other than this film. So you know, next month it'll be 2 years where I have been living, breathing, and dreaming about this movie. In fact, you popped up in my dream recently, and it was odd.
Was that winning an Oscar in your dream?
You might have been. You might have been. No, it was a lot darker. You had framed me for some crime. You'd framed me for some, and it was so obvious that I hadn't done the crime. I hadn't committed this murder, but it was you. You were the villain. Yeah, it was odd, and yet,
a movie out of that.
And yet, you were standing there when the police arrived, and I was trying to convince him. I said, "Please, Alec Baldwin killed him, not me." And
you're saying I killed somebody?
Yeah. Oh no, you killed somebody. I was the one covered in blood. And it was a very bizarre dream. I meant to tell you about this last night.
Who was the person I killed?
I'm not sure, but you framed it on me.
Were we anywhere near the Supreme Court at the time? No. I mean, no. What I mean is. I'm just saying that, you know. Okay. Let's take some questions. I can't see back there. Who's got their hand up? I'm right on the aisle right there,
gosh.
Sir.
I was just wondering if you thought there would ever be a world without libraries. Would they ever become obsolete? Could you ever imagine that? Do you think they still will continue to be relevant in the future?
Well, are you aware of this piece that Forbes posted online about 6 weeks ago, talking about now that we have Google and Amazon, that libraries are obsolete? Librarians around the world shouted this piece right offline. Forbes was forced to take it down. So I don't envision a world where we don't have libraries. I think that Tony Marks, who's the president of the New York Public Library System, he was quoted just yesterday in an article where he said libraries are quietly the place where democracy can be saved.
And I also just wanted to mention that it's Halloween, and every Halloween I like to break out nightmares and watch that piece that you did where you get sucked into the video machine.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That was one of those ones on the resume that we talked about earlier.
Excuse me. Is there a movie that you haven't done yet that you're looking forward to doing that you could share with this small group?
My next film with Alec.
Oh, hey.
Yeah.
And what is the title of that going to be?
There's a script that I've been working on for a while about immigration, and unfortunately it's not a timely issue, so I've had to put that on the back burner. So I wrote a comedy about immigration, about rediscovering America through the eyes of an immigrant, and so that's slowly coming into the front burner.
Now, are you going to play the lead in that movie, too, or are you going to get out of the way and let other people have a chance?
The lead is a Latina, so I'm probably outside my range.
Right? Okay. Over here?
Just going back a ways, what was it like on the set of The Breakfast Club, and how did the cast get along?
On The Breakfast Club, everybody got along really well. I was 21 at the time. I was, you know, a few years out of high school. They put Judd and Allie and I back into a high school. We started attending classes just to sort of get that high school vibe. And again, we could be in a school and be anonymous. Anthony, Michael Hall, and Molly were still teenagers and still still had still. I think we're still going to school at the time. So, but yeah, we got along very well. I don't really attend any of the Breakfast Club reunions, and I've been criticized for that. But my castmates are, they've been very vocal and sort of wondering why I never show up. But how do you feel about doing retrospectives and doing them?
To be honest with you, I think that it depends on the nature of the film. You know, like these people talk about how much the movie means to them at that point in their life. And I hear people all the time talk about Breakfast Club helped me get through high school. You know, so with that in mind, I think what could possibly be wrong about going to the retrospective? You know, I mean, really, it has great meaning to them. And even though you don't share that, it's a job you did and you play a character. I'll let people come up to me and say, oh, I love this or I love that. And I'll sit there and go, oh, well, thank you. And, best of luck to you or whatever. But for you, if they have these retrospectives, I'm like, my God, I'll go with you. Let's go. Let's hang out. I want to attend the Breakfast Club reunion. That sounds like a blast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
That was Emilio Estevez. The Public is his latest movie, and it's currently on the festival circuit. I'll let you know when it's out in wide release. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.